This week, we re-examine a piece from the past. Who wrote Ode to a Skull? Was it inspired by an earlier medieval work? We continue by examining the legend of Espinosa, one of America's first mass murderers, and his trail of blood. Is his skull on display at one of the oldest commanderies in America? Stay tuned.
Welcome back to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry. Here's your host, Brother Robert Johnson.
Welcome back to the show. This is episode number 444. So we've got some great things going on this week. You know, what I'd love to do is, back in episode number 434, The Freemason Utopia in 2050, I read a short piece, and we described it as exploring a tale of an epic poem on the skull and the man who turned a friar's skull into a drinking cup. Now, that was a piece that came out of the Square and Compass magazine, which was one of the greatest Masonic magazines ever to come out, had such varied content. It was really amazing. And as I mentioned last week in the episode with Brother Patrick Day on the medieval grimoires, Brother Patrick was cool enough to find and send me the entire set of articles relating to that poem about the skull. And it was four articles, and some are a little shorter than others, but I think in this episode what we're going to do is we're going to start at number one, and we're going to read through all of the articles, and so you'll get a reread of the one from 434 as well. And the reason is because we want to keep them in order so that the continuity isn't lost on anybody who is looking to get these. And what I'll do is I'll turn the images that Brother Patrick Day was able to send me into PDF documents, and that'll be a bonus feature in the app as well. How do you get the app? Just head on over to wcypodcast.com and find out how to do that there. It's really just a download and a search. So I think you will all enjoy this week's episode. As I have been doing throughout this pandemic, we're not doing any advertisements except to say, if you want to help support this show, head on over to wcypodcast.com and click on support the show and see how you can become a contributor, a fellow, or a producer of the program. And as always, my eternal thanks goes out to all of our contributors, fellows, and producers, whether on PayPal or on Patreon. We can't do it without you guys. So you guys make this show happen. Let's get into that education right now.
Freemasons, those never kiss and tell pillars of society, always adhere to the values of ethics and high morals, observing the promises of their obligations. Well, almost always. There have been instances where society, depending on the social mores of the day, may have judged some of our brothers harshly for crossing the line. Some of those occasions by today's standards may seem as tame as a sleeping kitten, while others might raise the eyebrows of the most iniquitous among us. Judge for yourself. Brother Grant Wood painted the acclaimed American Gothic. Released in 1930, the painting shocked many when Wood said it was a portrait of a married couple. The scene depicts an elderly man holding a pitchfork, standing next to a much younger woman. The age difference caused a scandal, so Wood eventually said the woman represented the man's daughter. He would, in fact, change that story and say she was his wife, depending on how he perceived the audience would react. Brother Tom Mix was one of the earliest film superstars. In an era where moviegoers were unaccustomed to some of the antics of Hollywood actors, they were shocked at what one might call his practice of serial monogamy. Mix had five wives at a time when that number was considered just about four too many. After visiting the Soviet Union, Brother Will Rogers wrote a book entitled There's Not a Bathing Suit in Russia and Other Bare Facts. Suggested by the standards of the day, the publisher declined to put the second part of the title on the book's cover. Anthony Butler was the ward and friend of Brother Andrew Jackson and, yes, a Freemason. Jackson appointed Butler his secret agent in a surreptitious plan to purchase Texas for the United States. Upon arriving in Texas, Butler crossed swords with Brother Stephen F. Austin, who was establishing colonies there. While there, Butler began courting the daughter of a prominent Mexican family. Austin was a friend of the family. Upon hearing what Butler was up to, he exposed him as a man who had a wife and three children back in the U.S., fueling a lifetime of animosity between the two Masonic brothers. Brother Chick Sale never achieved a great amount of fame until he published a book entitled The Specialist. The book sold 200,000 copies in 3 months and went on to be a million seller. Its subject? Outhouses. Considered risque for its time, the book was nearly banned, but Brother Sale chose his words just carefully enough to avoid having it censored. Brother Glenn Ford starred in the 1946 blockbuster Gilda. In one scene, his co-star, Rita Hayworth, performed a strip tease in which she removed nothing more than one glove. That and a rumored affair between the two co-stars nearly caused the censors to ban the movie. Brother Harry Lieferant was a prolific author. As editor of True Story magazine, he was responsible for its rise to popularity and reputation as an off-color magazine, when he developed the story format whereby a heroine, quote, violates standards of behavior, suffers a consequence, learns her lesson, and resolves to live in light of it, unembittered by her pain, end quote. True Story magazine still survives using Brother Lieferant's tried and true, if not slightly salacious, format known as Sin, Suffer, Repent. A 1960s Grand Lodge of California account describes a crime in which a brother had been convicted of the theft of clothing, including 181 pairs of women's undergarments. The official police report described the incident as a panty raid stemming from the popular and self-explanatory hijinks occurring on college campuses at the time. The brother came up on Masonic charges. In order to distinguish his serious crime from some youthful indiscretion, the Grand Lodge of California proceedings included the following. Quote, "We do not wish to be misunderstood as overemphasizing the gravity of that specification against the accused in which he is charged with a panty raid. Indulgence in such conduct by boys of college age for the purpose of displaying either skill or courage, if that be the purpose, differs from the conduct of the accused here in that the theft of 181 pairs of ladies' underpants is not merely a playful prank." End quote. The Presbyterian Church in 1831 sanctioned Nathaniel Beverly Tucker, second Grand Master of the Grand Lodge of Missouri, for shocking unchristian conduct. Certain parties, it seems, claimed he, quote, partook of the amusement of dancing, end quote, on three occasions. There is no record of any action taken against him, but shortly thereafter, Most Worshipful Brother Tucker became an Episcopalian. Brother Will Rogers asked his wife Betty to marry him in 1906. Betty, apprehensive about a life in show business, turned him down. A year and a half later, the persistent Rogers changed her mind and they married. In the meantime, Rogers dated every one of Betty's six sisters. Brother Potter Stewart, Supreme Court Justice, once said of obscenity, "I can't define it, but I know it when I see it." That might apply to each of these little scenarios. As you form your opinion about their appropriateness, you might do well to drag your Bible off the shelf and read Matthew 7, verses 1 to 3. And while you're at it, ask yourself if the subject piqued your interest. For the Whence Came You podcast, this is Steve Harrison with the Masonic Minute.
All right. As usual, a huge thanks goes out to illustrious Brother Harrison for his amazing contributions. You gotta love the history that he gives us. These did you knows that he gives us additional information, additional context, all while telling us a great story. If you're interested in more of things like that, I cannot recommend enough Steve Harrison's books. You can head on over to the website, wcypodcast.com. Click on the bookstore, and you'll find his books there. In addition, check out the Missouri Lodge of Research. We'll have links to that, where you can get a copy of the Ray V. Denslow set for way less than you can buy them individually. Let's get into the education for the week. Skull Practice, Ode to the Skull, by George B. Clark. Behold this ruin, 'tis a skull. Once of ethereal spirits full, this narrow cell was life's retreat. This space was thought's mysterious seat. What beauteous visions filled this spot, what dreams of pleasure long forgot. Nor joy, nor grief, nor hope, nor fear has left one trace on record here. Beneath this moldering canopy once shone a bright and busy eye. Yet start not at the dismal void. If holy love that eye employed, if with no lawless fire it gleamed, but through the dews of kindness beamed, that eye shall be forever bright when stars and sun are sunk in night. Within this hollow cavern hung the ready, swift, and tuneful tongue. If falsehood's honey is disdained, and when it could not praise was chained, if bold in virtue's cause it spoke, yet gentle concord never broke, that silent tongue may plead for thee when time unveils eternity. When I first heard this soliloquy, it was part of a solemn ceremony, all of which made a deep and lasting impression. When later I sought out the poem, I was surprised to find that no authorship was assigned to it. Further investigation revealed various peculiarities and variation, and increased my interest. As quoted above, the poem has three stanzas of 8 lines each. Here, its title appears as Ode to the Skull. Later, I found it extended to 5 stanzas of 8 lines each, and with the title To a Skeleton. Still, another form is 10 stanzas and 4 lines each. Various copies also differ in minor respects. For example, line 12 is sometimes given as If Social Love That I Employed, and again as If Holy Love That I Employed. There are differences in punctuation and capitalization, in the use of the apostrophe instead of the letter E, in the last syllable of a word, etc. The copy which follows shows most of the variations when compared with the poem as quoted at the beginning of the article. To a Skeleton. Behold this ruin, 'twas a skull. Once of ethereal spirit full, this narrow cell was life's retreat. This space was thought's mysterious seat. What beauteous visions filled this spot, what dreams of pleasure long forgot. Nor hope, nor joy, nor love, nor fear have left one trace of record here. Beneath this moldering canopy once shone the bright and busy eye. But start not at the dismal void, if social love that eye employed, if with no lawless fur it gleamed, but through the dews of kindness beamed, that eye shall be forever bright when stars and sun are sunk in night. Within this hollow cavern hung the ready, swift, and tuneful tongue, if falsehood's honey is disdained, and when it could not praise was chained, if bold in virtue's cause it spoke, yet gentle concord never broke, this silent tongue shall plead for thee when time unveils eternity. Say, did these fingers delve the mine, or with the envied ruby shine, to hew the rock, or wear a gem, can little now avail to them. But if the page of truth they sought, or comfort to the mourner brought, these hands a richer meed shall claim than all that wait on health and fame. Avail it, whether bare or shod, these feet the paths of duty trod. If from the bowers of ease they fled to seek affliction's humble shed, if grandeur's guilty bribe they spurned and home to virtue's continued returned, these feet with angel wings shall vie and tread the palace of the sky. Yea, editor of Square and Compass, was for many years secretary of Rob Morris Lodge No. 92 of Denver, and in the November 1914 issue of the Rob Morris Bulletin, he published the poem, its 10 stanzas of 4 lines each, variety entitled Lines to a Skeleton, and credited the authorship as anonymous or unknown. Evidently, the poem caused much commotion even then, because in the January 1915 issue of the Bulletin, he published this. Quote, Lines to a Skeleton in the November issue are used with effect in one of the concordant orders. They were first published anonymously in London Morning Chronicle, 1827. A reward of 50 guineas was offered for the author's name, which remained a secret for nearly 60 years, when it was learned that the poem was written by Robert Phillips Gormire of Scotland. He wrote the verses while watching for body snatchers in the parish churchyard of Torpichan, where, during the repairing of the church, the unearthing of a skeleton suggested the subject. The verses were shown to Dr. John Alfred, who procured a copy and either by accident or intention dropped a copy in the Royal College of Surgeons, where they were found and published. End quote. The story about the poem has been told many times in many ways, but perhaps the best accordant account appeared in the Minneapolis Journal under the date of June 12, 1929. The 40-line poem is first quoted under the title Lines to a Skeleton, Author Unknown. Then this story follows. Quote, The authorship of the above poem has never been ascertained. It is all as much of a mystery as the Man in the Iron Mask or the authorship of the Junius Letters. One account attributes the authorship to an unknown ghost who haunted an old library in London. The story of the finding of this poem is an interesting one. It was written by an unknown hand in the library of the Museum of the Royal College of Physicians and Surgeons of London. An attendant of the museum was passing through the library during a holiday and observed 2 sheets of paper lying on a table. A pen, ink, and skull were the only other objects. He picked up the sheets and noticed that they were still damp. He blotted them carefully and turned them over to the librarian, who at once demanded to know who had been admitted on a day when no visitors were allowed. The rebuked attendant hurried away in search of the offender. Only a professor and 2 janitors were to be found in the building. He hurried back to his superior and recommended that the verses be burned, as they had evidently been written by a supernatural hand. This was seriously considered by the librarian, but thinking it over, he decided to show them to the dean of the college upon his arrival next morning. The poem lay upon the dean's desk for some days, and was read and copied by a great many professors and visitors. One of the visitors, it is said, sent it to the London Morning Chronicle, and it was printed in that journal. The poem made a remarkable impression on the mind of the public, and demand arose for the name of the author. It was thought for a time that a professor of the college had written the verses, but each of them disclaimed all credit. For 10 years following the incident, the question of authorship was frequently revived, and finally a reward was offered for anyone who could furnish proof, $250 being offered for such information. No one has ever been able to claim the reward. Although it was claimed that the first printed copy of the poem was in the London Morning Chronicle and unsigned, it was found in a European magazine for November 1816, signed with the initial V. That was the signature used by an English authoress, Miss Anne Jane Boardhill, afterwards Miss Jane Niven of Glenarm. This young lady wrote many poems for the European magazine printed over the same initial, but she denied an authorship of Lines to a Skeleton. Many writers, when they wish to conceal their identity, use initial V or X, and not infrequently X, Y, or Z. So time went on, and 100 years have passed, and more and more, and the authorship of the poem still remains as deep a mystery as ever. It is not probable that it will ever be solved. Thus, the matter stood until recently, I found in the Denver Public Library, a volume published by the Garden City Publishing Company of New York City entitled The Best Loved Poems of the American People, selected by Hazel Feldman. On page 624 of this book appears the poem To a Skeleton and the authorship ascribed to Anna Jane Vardhill. I wrote to Miss Feldman and asked her how the authorship was discovered. She replied as follows, quote, "Shortly after my anthology came out, the publishers started a publicity stunt to find the authors of all the anonymous poems in the book by offering, as a reward, $10 to anyone who could identify with proof the poem in that group. A number of them were located, and the names of the authors were printed in the second printing of Best Loved Poems of the American People. I think that To a Skeleton was one of these." And thus ends part one. Part two, Skull Practice, George Clark. Quote, "As I did not handle any part of the work that referred to the money awards, I am not able to tell you more than I have about the matter you write, except as to say that you can be quite satisfied that the name of Anne Jane Vardhill would not appear as the author of the poem if it were not correct. We shall have to take the publisher's decision on it." End quote. Inquiry of the Garden City Publishing Company revealed that the records pertaining to the book and the contest have been placed in an at present inaccessible place. However, they assure me that when these records can be reached, they will write me again. A critical analysis of the two forms in which the poem has appeared suggests that the 24-line version was written first under the title To a Skull or Ode to the Skull. Then, at some subsequent period, another writer, being impressed by the poem, added a fourth and fifth stanzas in which mention is made of hands and feet, and the basic idea of a soliloquy on the skull is changed to one of a skeleton. The poem then became known as To a Skeleton. 8 years earlier then appeared the poem To a Skeleton, which is now credited to the almost unknown Anna Jane Vardhill, had come a famous poem from the pen of a well-known author and on a similar subject, lines inscribed upon a cup formed from a skull by Lord George Gordon Byron. It would be interesting, could we know, if there had been some association between these poets, or if it was a case of similar channels, or was it mere coincidence? These are the stanzas of the earlier poem, lines inscribed upon a cup formed from a skull. "Start not, nor deem my spirit fled. In me behold the only skull from which unlike a living head. Whatever flows is never dull. I lived, I loved, I quaffed like thee, I died, let earth my bones resign. Fill up, thou canst not injure me, the worm hath fouler lips than thine. Better to hold the sparkling grape than nurse the earth worm's slimy brood, and circle in the goblet's shape the drink of gods than reptiles' food. When once my wit perchance has shone, in aid of others let me shine. And when, alas, our brains are gone, what nobler substitute than wine? Quaff while thou canst another race, when thou and thine like me are sped, may rescue thee from earth's embrace, and rhyme and revel with the dead. Why not, since, through life's little day, our heads such sad effects produce, redeemed from worms and wasting clay, this chance is theirs to be of use." Byron went to Trinity College, Cambridge, where he led a reckless and defiant life and left without taking a degree. His drinking cup, made of a human skull, became notorious and was the inspiration for his poem. Byron gave the following account of the cup in his Conversations with Medwin. Quote, "The gardener in digging discovered a skull that had probably belonged to some jolly friar or monk of the abbey about the time it was demonasterized. Observing it to be of great size and in perfect state of preservation, a strange fancy seized me of having it set and mounted as a drinking cup. I accordingly sent it to town, and it returned with a very high polish and of a mottled color like a turquoise shell." End quote. Byron took his cup home to Newstead and we are told that he and his guests dined at 8, and after the cloth was removed, handed round a human skull filled with burgundy. To be continued. Part 3. Not long ago, my attention was attracted to a beautiful poem written about a not-so-beautiful subject, a skull. The story of this poem was told in a former article published in the August issue of the Square and Compass. The poem recalled to my mind the circumstance that many years ago, when I was being shown through the apartments of a Masonic temple in Denver, I saw in the trophy case of Colorado Commandery No. 1, Knight Templar, a skull. This skull rested on a low pedestal, and attached was a card to the effect that the skull was actually one in which life was part of a famous desperado of an earlier day named Espinosa. The incongruity of skull and beautiful silver service was startling. Because of the poem and of the memory it induced, I then began a search for that old skull. I could not find it, nor could I find anyone who knew of it or that it had once been on exhibition. However, I did find mention of it in the historical sketch of Colorado Commandery No. 1 Knight Templar issued in 1941 on the occasion of the 75th anniversary of the Commandery. Here's what I found. Quote, in the year 1864, a most desperate and bloodthirsty band of outlaws had been for a long time committing all kinds of depredations and murder in the mountain regions, and in order to put this at rest, at this point, the article seems to have a comma, but then moves on to a next paragraph. Continuing on. This extract was written in 1891 by Webster D. Anthony, prominent as a Colorado pioneer and as a Mason, a past commander of Colorado Commandery No. 1, and a past Grand Commander of the Grand Commandery of Colorado. He hints at an interesting story of early days in Colorado, and the incident is told in considerable detail in History of Colorado by Frank Hall, Volume 1, page 378. The story is as follows. In the spring of the year mentioned, 1863, an entire region of country between Pueblo and Park counties, indeed all sections of the territory, became in a measure panic-stricken by account of a terrible and mysterious massacre of travelers on the lonely roads leading from the southwest to the South Park. Every little while, residents of certain localities disappeared, and upon search being instituted by friends, their dead bodies were found. Who committed these horrible deeds no one could comprehend, since all traces were lost. The first victim in the neighborhood of Cannon City we follow, Captain Rockefeller's narrative, was William Bruce on Hardscrabble Creek. He went to his sawmill 12 miles from his residence, but not returning to his home at the time expected, search was made, when he was found shot through the heart. While wondering over this tragic event, another strange murder occurred at another sawmill in El Paso County on the little fountain about 60 miles from the scene mentioned above, where the body of an old man named Harkins was found killed, apparently with a hatchet. Next, a man named Adelman was slain on his ranch situated near the road leading from Colorado City to the South Park. Next, a brother of Colonel George L. Shoup and a man named Binkley were found butchered in the Red Hills in the park itself. Soon after, a man named Carter was killed at Cottage Grove near Alma. Then, two men named Lehman and Segia shared the fate in the Red Hills. An admirable place for the assassins because of the concealment offered by the thickets and timber nearby. Consternation filled every mind. The air was loaded with rumors, but not a soul could give even the faintest clue to the origin or purpose of the South Park region, for it was there that the greatest number of bodies had been found. No one dared to venture out upon the roads by day or night, for none had escaped death who did so. To be continued. Part 4. Skull Practice, George B. Clark. While riding through the region on horseback in the summer of 1864, the different scenes of these murders were pointed out to me, and the principal incidents so far as they were known related by a companion who was a resident of California Gulch. From this source, I learned that the first clue discovered occurred somewhat as follows. Quote, the driver of an ox team who was hauling a load of lumber from the neighborhood of what is now Alma to Fairplay was fired upon from a thicket by the roadside. The shot struck his left breast but was stopped from entering his body by a copy of Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation and a memorandum book in his breast pocket. Looking instantly in the direction from which the bullet had come, he discovered two men, whom he at first thought to be Indians from their tawny color, but a second glance proved them to be Mexicans. He had little time for reflection, however. His team, affrighted by the sharp report of his rifle, ran away as fast as their legs could carry them, and though one of the Mexicans drew his gun to shoulder for a second shot, it was not fired. Speeding in all haste to Fair Play, the driver related his experience to the citizens when measures were taken for pursuit. Captain John McCannon, who led the first party in search of the Espinosas, the name of those Mexican butchers, subsequently wrote a detailed account of it, from which it appears that Lehman and Sega were residents of California Gulch, and when the news of their murder reached the Gulch, a meeting was called for the purpose of raising funds and volunteers to track the assassins. A call for volunteers being made, the following responded: Joseph M. Lamb, Julius Sanger, O.T. McCannon, Thomas C. Wells, C.F. Wilson, W.M. R. McComb, John Gilbert, Frank Miller, Fred Fredericks, W.M. Young, James Foley, John Landon, Charles Nanthrop, John Holtz, John Endelman, William Woodward, and John McCannon, the latter being elected commander of the company. Proceeding to the South Park, they scouted the country in every direction, the command being divided into detachments. At length, after much night and day scouting, a trail was discovered which led Captain McCannon and the men with him to the hunt of the Bloody Espinosas, a weird cannon on the west side of the 4 Mile Creek near a dense thicket of willows. Here they found two horses, one hobbled in a little park on the south side of the gulch. Says McCannon, "I dispatched Foley, Young, Fredericks, and Lawden with instructions to go round the bluff and get into the cannon below, and to carefully push their way along up the cannon while we cover the horses with our guns. In a short time, the largest of the Espinosas came out of the willows and commenced taking off the hobbles that held his horse. Joseph M. Lamb fired, the ball breaking the second rib on his right side and passing directly through, broke the second rib on the left side. Sanger fired next with buckshot, but the horse stumbling over the desperado received the charge. Espinosa raised up his elbow and commenced firing at me. As I had left my position to look after the other one, supposing that Lamb's and Sanger's firing had done the work, Charles Carter then fired, the ball striking Espinosa between the eyes and ranging back, killed him instantly. The other one came in sight, but got off without a shot, through a mistake. I had my gun leveled on him, when Julius Sanger called out, 'For God's sake, don't kill Billy Young.' They were about the same size and were dressed alike. I dropped my gun to get a better look, and he, the Espinosa, seeing my motion, threw himself into the ravine and was seen no more. Making his escape back to New Mexico, he picked up a nephew, a mere boy, and after a time returned upon the old trail. Meanwhile, however, rewards were offered for the murderers by the governor and the relatives of some of the murdered men, the whole amounting to $1,500, which stimulated others to the chase, among them an old mountaineer named Tom Tobins, then, as now, a resident of San Luis Valley. Taking a few soldiers from Fort Garland, Tobins began a close and rapid search of the trail of the remaining Espinosas, and finally discovered their encampment by his thorough knowledge of the secrets of the mountain and of the signs in the air. Noticing a faint column of smoke ascending from a thicket and looking up into the air, he saw ravens circling the spot, which indicated to his well-trained mind the presence of men and the preparation of a meal in the thicket. Crawling upon his hands and knees, using great care not to make a sound by the breaking of a twig or rustling of a leaf, he came close upon the encampment without discovery. When in a good position to make his aim certain, he fired and killed the elder Espinosa, both of them, in fact, and brought the head of the principal assassin to Fort Garland. Thus terminated the lives of two of the worst assassins that ever cursed our country. They were religious lunatics, fanatics, and murdered as offerings to the Virgin. By a memorandum book taken from one of the Espinosas for a long time in my possession, it was found that they had killed 32 Americans in the course of their different raids. An ugly-looking butcher knife taken at the same time was for some years among the trophies of the Adjutant General's office in this city." End quote. In another chapter of Hall's History of Colorado, we find this. Tobins, or properly Tom Tobin, was a noted scout guide, Indian fighter, hunter, and trapper, the greater part of his life having been spent in those pursuits. He was for a time employed by Colonel William Gilpin in trailing hostile Navajos away back in the 40s and later by other military commanders. He posed a great skill and courage, which was a dead shot with his old muzzle-loading rifle, strong, hardy, inured to every form of privation, intelligent and cunning, therefore a valuable assistant in the service to which he was so frequently called. The reward offered Tobin by the governor was never paid, to my knowledge, says Saul Francisco, and the only thing, in my opinion, that he ever received was a silver-mounted rifle donated by private individuals. In the summer of 1889, Colonel George L. Shoup, now 1890, and for many years, a resident of Idaho Territory, in recognition of Tobin's worth as a man, scout, and guide, but more especially for his distinguished service of ridding the world of the bloody butcher of his, Shoup's brother, sent Tobin a draft for $200. This, together with the rifle, so far as known, is the only substantial reward the heroic Tobin ever received. The Espinosa skull is still in possession of the Commandery No. 1, and even now does its part in directing the thought of the pilgrim to the better things and better ways. Again, we are reminded of the words of the philosopher, "Ever sweet has its sour, every evil its good." And that's the conclusion of the four-part series. Now, what I find amazing, it's really a two-part piece, right? It's this, first he leads us into what is considered the history of this poem, and then a story about the skull that got him started on the research, and it's really fascinating. It's a classic frontier tale, which I'm sure as we read it, we can kind of envision what's going on. And, of course, the somewhat medieval feel of the soliloquy, as it were. You know, I'm really curious, what version of the poem did you like best? The super short version that was to the skull, or the later edition, or the even later edition? Or did you really like the one that came even before all of this that was very much different? If you've got an opinion on that, please shoot me a message, wcypodcast@gmail.com. You can leave us a message on Facebook, on the blog page, whatever, and we'll go ahead and get to it. Really appreciate everybody listening this week. My special thanks goes out to worshipful Brother Patrick Day for his dedication in getting me those pieces, and I really appreciate that. Now we have a full picture of exactly what George Clark was thinking about when he was researching where this poem came from and his thoughts on the skull. With that, I hope you all have a wonderful week. And one more thanks goes out to our supporters. If you're interested in supporting the show, please head on over to wcypodcast.com and click on Support the Show. That's it for this week. We'll talk to you all next week. Until then, stay on the level. For Whence Came You, I'm Robert Johnson.
You've been listening to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry with your host, Brother Robert Johnson. Be sure to join us for our next edition.